Guest this week is an amazing woman who at the age of 78 is still enjoying an active career as a beloved entertainer and is regarded by music critics and historians as one of the greatest rock and roll vocalists of all time. In her bio, posted on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame website, to which she was inducted in 2011, it says that Rolling Stone proclaimed our guest one of the greatest singers of all time, while the New York Times declared that her thunderbolt voice is as embedded in the history of rock and roll as Eric Clapton's guitar or Bob Dylan's lyrics. However, her name doesn't quite have the familiar ring of Clapton's and Dylan's. That's because for much of her life she worked in relative anonymity in studios and on stages, backing up others. The bio continues, for her behind-the-scenes role as popular music's greatest session vocalist and backup singer, she's been called the most successful unknown singer in rock and roll history. Virtually everyone knows her voice, but only a relative few know to whom that magical voice belongs. With her induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, that hopefully will no longer be the case. Our guest sang lead on a string of Phil Spector-produced hits from the early 60s, the ones that established his legendary wall of sound, including He's a Rebel, He's Sure the Boy I Love, Zippity-Doo-Dah, Today I Met the Boy I'm Gonna Marry, Wait Till My Bobby Gets Home, Why Do Lovers Break Each Other's Hearts, and the seasonal classic Christmas Baby Please Come Home that she sang on the David Letterman Show each year for the final quarter century of his late-night run on CBS. In addition, she sang background vocals on numerous other hits that Spector produced for his Phillies label, including the Crystals' "Da Do Run Run," the Ronettes' "Be My Baby," and the Righteous Brothers' "You've Lost That Lovin' Feeling." Among rock cognoscenti, she's best known for He's a Rebel, a song credited to the Crystals that was actually sung by our guest in her vocal group, The Blossoms. The reason for this odd situation has to do with the record's producer, Phil Spector. He instinctively knew that the song, written by Gene Pitney, would be a hit, but he couldn't record it with the Crystals, his main recording group at that time, because they were back home in Brooklyn while he was out in Los Angeles, impatient to get the song recorded before a competing version by Vicky Carr could gain momentum. So he cut He's a Rebel with the Blossoms, crediting it to the Crystals because he wanted a recognizable name on the record, and they had two recent hits, Uptown and There's No Other Like My Baby. As unconventional as it might sound, Spector's strategy worked, and He's a Rebel topped the charts in 1962. However, it didn't make a star of our guest. It just provided her and her group, The Blossoms, with more background work. Indeed, our guest and The Blossoms became first call A-list session singers, boasting a sessionography that almost defies belief. With The Blossoms, our guest has sung with the likes of Sam Cooke, Elvis Presley, The Beach Boys, Jan and Dean, The Mamas and the Papas, Duane Eddy, Sonny and Cher, Frank Sinatra, Tom Jones, Luther Vandross, and Dionne Warwick. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. Hard to believe, the background singers that appear on Frank Sinatra's classic That's Life are the same performers we hear backing up Bobby Boris Pickett on Monster Mash. And there were tough times as well. At one point in her career when the gig started slowing down and her marriage was on the rocks, our guest had to moonlight as a housekeeper to make ends meet. But a roots rock revival brought our guest into the limelight during the 80s. First, she resumed her solo career in 1981 with club shows in and around Los Angeles. In 1984, she starred in one of the first successful jukebox musicals, Leader of the Pack, which had extended runs at New York's Bottom Line and on Broadway. She also did dramatic work, appearing in all three Lethal Weapons movies and a stage adaptation of Stephen King's Carrie. She then appeared for a few years in a leading role in the Broadway production of Hairspray. Her amazing story became even further known with the 2013 release of the Academy Award-winning documentary film 20 Feet from Stardom. Today, at 78 years of age, she continues to appear on television and sell out venues across the country and around the world. Our guest this week is the legendary Darlene Love. Welcome to the Michael Harrison Interview, the weekly podcast from Podcast One for media freaks, pop culture aficionados, political junkies, and the philosophically curious. Thank you for downloading this program from Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, and the Podcast One app, and for following our Tuesday tweets announcing the names of our weekly guests. To sign up, it's at MH Interview. I can be reached directly via email at michael@talkers.com. If you find this show to be of interest and value, please subscribe to it as well as giving it a positive 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. We'll dive right into an uninterrupted conversation with Darlene Love right after this brief programming reminder from Podcast One.
Hi, this is Jillian with Court Junkie, a true crime podcast that covers court cases and criminal trials using audio clips and interviews. I'm excited to announce that I have formed a partnership with the Law and Crime Network, and that Court Junkie will now be releasing episodes every week. Some episodes include the case of a man who admitted to dismembering his father's body, but who swears at trial that he didn't kill him, and the case of a woman who is charged with murder after she pushed her husband, causing him to fall out of a high-rise building. Court Junkie is available on Apple Podcasts and PodcastOne.com.
Okay, here we go. An uninterrupted conversation with Darlene Love. Have had such a long and interesting career. Not only that you're so talented and people love your music, but you are an interesting woman. You've had some amazing experiences. And one of the things that I have found following you, and I was one of those people who used to say, you know who the most underrated, uncelebrated, greatest singer in rock and roll history is? Darlene Love. And back in the old days, people would say, who's that?
Who's that?
And I would explain, you know, remember, he's a rebel and, you know, down, you know, all that stuff. And it's amazing. Half of your career, it seems, was spent being underrated, unknown, not celebrated, yes, not exactly. Paid. And then half your career is like you've got this whole amazing career going based on springboarding off the injustice of that. How was the transition? I mean, obviously, did it change in one day, or you know, what was it like going from that first period of your career to where you are now in terms of avoiding bitterness? You know, people fall into terrible psychological states when they don't get their due, and you've been through a lot. How was that journey for you?
Well, you know what? The journey wasn't as hard as it seemed when you look back at it. But looking at it when I was going through it, it was almost day to day. How am I going to do this? Why am I doing this? Why do I want to start a solo career at the age of 40? Why am I not just staying as a backup singer and getting all the accolades and not having to spend a whole lot of money being a backup singer? Because once you take over being the lead, then you take over all the responsibilities of taking care of all the business, getting people to work, paying them, you know, and you don't really think about it that way until you get in that position, which is unbelievable. But you have no idea, even though I had seen it for years as a backup singer, but it wasn't thrust upon me, you know. I was paid to, they bought my clothes, they paid for my travel, they bought my food and everything. But once I became the lead, I had to do all that. So the transformation was gradual, you know, because it was a lot of setbacks. Okay, I went 10 feet and then it backed up 5 feet. And I think because it was gradual, I didn't have time to suffer or be mad or angry or hate the injustice that was being done. Because I was always able to work and make great money as a backup singer, or even if it wasn't a backup singer at the time, you know, I'd get a great, great job. You know, and that would take care of me for a couple of months.
There seems to be, Darlene, a third category, and I just I just recently saw. I can't believe I didn't know you were in the movie. I just thought it was an indie film, and I would get around to it 20 feet from stardom, and then finally, I would have watched it. I believe it came out in 2013, and it's already 2019, and I saw it was on Netflix. I figured I'll check it out, and I said, "Oh my gosh, Darlene Love is in this!" And I watched it, and I watched it twice and three times, and I've recommended it to a lot of people, and it has tremendous information about you and a whole slew of female singers, very talented, with different stories. And it occurred to me that there's this third category, and you straddled it. There's the backup singer who was hired, or maybe even to this day is still hired. At last minute, you go to the studio, they give you the music, they tell you what to do, they either pay you outright, whatever, and then you walk away and you go away and they want to get rid of you. And then, of course, there's the lead singer in show business who who's the star and carries the weight of that. But there was this middle ground, it seems, in the 60s of what we now look back at as the girl groups. And so many of them were African-American. And I don't know whether they weren't really backup singers. They were sort of leads. And but some of them, I hear stories that the secretary was said, "Hey, get in the studio and sing." And all of a sudden she had a hit, but she didn't have any money. I mean, this seemed to have been a syndrome. What was it like being in a girl group? You're not a backup singer. You're in a group.
I was in a group.
Right.
Yeah, and I never thought of, we didn't even call ourselves backup singers then, because we were a group. Backup singers didn't come along till much, much later. Maybe 10, 15 years later, they started giving them the name as backup a singer, because we were unique as a group. As backup singers, because usually from the union that we were in after, they would call you and say, "We need three singers, we need four singers, we need a choir or whatever." And then those were the backup singers. Well, they didn't really call us backup singers, because we were a group. Whenever we went to do a session, they said, "We want the Blossoms, not three backup singers. We want the Blossoms," whether they wanted four of us, three of us, five of us, or however many they wanted with us. So we got to see a lot of wonderful things as backup singers. So we didn't really feel bad or mistreated, because they needed us as much as we needed to do their sessions.
Right.
So a lot of the sessions that we did back in the 60s and the 70s and even all the way up to the 80s, these giant entertainers were so happy that we were able to do their background. So it's like you said, I never thought of it. It was a medium, a three-part thing.
Right.
One where we were really the background singers, and then we were the lead singers as a group, and then you have just background singers.
Right. You were a group that served as a group background, and you already had your harmony and knew. You know what amazed me when I saw the 20 Feet from Stardom was that the Blossoms were the group that sang behind Bobby Boris Pickett in Monster Mash? The same female singers that were on that were the ones that were singing some of those Phil Spector legendary Wall of Sound songs. That's pretty amazing.
Well, you know what? Being producers back in those days, especially record producers, they were really coming into their own back in those days, and they wanted the best singers they could find to help them get where they were trying to go. And they used us, like in movies. I mean, people are funny when we did a background for Doris Day. I mean, it sounds strange to say that today, because we knew her son, Terry Melchner, and he was recording her, and he wanted us to do her background for Move Over Darling, for the movie. So that's how we got in those positions, because of who the producers were.
I see.
We didn't know at that time we were doing that song and it was going into a movie. The same thing with Bobby Pickett. We knew we were going to do the background for that song, but we didn't know it was going to end up being what it was, because we did a whole lot of records that nothing ever happened to them.
Wow. I'll bet you there are some great records out there that nobody knows about that have you on them, and the Blossoms and these names that we're mentioning. You know, we're just talking about the big ones, although it has
to... like Annette Bray. I mean, you know, we knew her because of her producer. So, I mean, you know, a lot of it happened because of the position we were in as famous, unknown background singers.
Right. But I always considered you and these groups to be stars. You know, I think the movie's name, 20 Feet from Stardom, is what kept me from immediately going to it, because mm-hmm. you were stars even when you weren't stars.
I see that.
You know what I mean? Those were hit records, and I would imagine a lot of it had to do with how enterprising you were just as a businesswoman, that some of the women that were in these groups were not that aggressive or maybe didn't know how to handle themselves. I get the impression that you always had your head on straight, even back then. The relationships must have been those of mentors and people that were students among the women that were in these groups, and you struck me as a mentor. Am I correct?
Yeah, that's very true. You know, you don't know that at the time. You're leading, but you don't realize you're taking over the leading roles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people call you, you call the singers, you tell them what your price is, the hours, where we're working. This was a lot of paperwork back in those days, because we had to report every session to AFTRA. So we had to fill out forms. We had to talk to the producers. He had to sign the form. I mean, so, but we were young, and in those days it didn't seem like a whole lot. When I look back now, I said, my God, how did we do it?
Yeah, well, you know, that's hindsight is 20/20 vision. You mentioned before the producers were looking for good singers to make them sound good. Of course, Phil Spector was a revolutionary, groundbreaking, legendary producer, and you have an interesting history with him that has been well documented. I won't get into that at all, really, because it's out there. But today, the producers still have an enormous role in shaping the sound of a singer. But I find that with today's technology, music has become a producer's business more than a singer's business. In other words, they can even take somebody who can't sing, who's, you know, pitchy or off key or tone deaf, and make them sound good with the equipment. It's pretty remarkable how the role of producer has changed over the years.
It has. You know, when I first heard the word vocal tuner, and I said, asked them, what is a vocal tuner? They said, well, that's somebody that can't sing or really can't stay on tune or can't stay on pitch. I said, wait a minute. I mean, you take somebody in the studio who I will not even name, and you do a record with them, and then you have to take it in and it's almost like video shop it.
Right.
You know, get
right.
them, and they make them sing the lines over and over again, and they can go back in and take four of those lines and pick the best one out of that line and put it in the record. And I said, my God, this is crazy. So, you know, it's almost like now you don't really have to have talent to go into the recording studio and make a great record.
You really don't.
It has fallen on the producer to create this record, and the writers get together and they create it, and then they present it to the singer.
Which
is amazing.
When you were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, you gave a very, very lovely shout out to Paul Schaefer, who the camera captured, and he seemed very touched by it.
I was surprised. I said, but you deserve that.
Yeah, and it relates to what you were just saying about the producers. He really seemed to go all out as the years went on, the quarter century that you would do the Christmas song on the David Letterman show, recreating live, I guess it was live, the Phil Spector Wall of Sound. And that was a pretty remarkable thing to witness. He's a very talented guy, isn't he?
He's amazing, because we would get calls from, you know, entertainers that we knew, like the Righteous Brothers or Bette Midler or someone. How in the world do you guys keep doing this better and better every year? Well, to tell you the truth, it didn't just happen.
Right.
You know, things great don't just happen, and they don't happen by accident. You work at it. He brings the choir that sings behind me or whoever's going to sing the background in like 12 hours before we even do the show and rehearse them. Like, they'd never rehearsed that song before. They'd never sung that song before. By now, they'd been singing it 10 years. And plus, some of those singers that were there were my personal singers. So they, of course, knew that song back when. That wasn't the idea. The idea was, I'm going to get this song and the music as perfect, as close to what the original sound was as I can. And that's what he went out to do, and that's exactly what he did. No matter who it was or when it was. Even when we first did that song on the show, I love the first show because it's amazing. It was only the five musicians that he used permanently on the show, and they were the singers also. I didn't even bring my singers to that first show.
Well, you know,
and just Paul Schaefer and those musicians did the first one. And it's amazing what it sounded like.
Well, the sound is very iconic, and it shows that Paul Schaefer has an appreciation and an ear for that. The original Phil Spector wall of sound that marked those Crystals and Darlene Love and Bobby Sox and the Blue Jeans and all the different names that were used on the labels, which still to this day confuses me, that sound is something that certain people really understood and tried to emulate. Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band, and even before that, I believe the Dave Clark Five took that sound and later in the 60s, in the mid-60s, touched into it. Would you agree with the sax and the heavy production?
Oh, yeah, because you know what? Nobody was doing what Phil was doing.
Mm-hmm.
Not only that, nobody was what we called overdubbing.
Right.
To my knowledge, Phil Spector was one of the first producers to start doing overdubbing, even with the lead voice, the background, and all the musicians. He would overdub all that sound, and it sounded like it was an orchestra in there at the same time.
Right.
They were in there at different times.
Yeah, he wasn't the
first sound that he wanted, then he added to it.
Right. He wasn't the first to do it, but he was the first to do it on that gigantic level. He took it to a height. And your performance with Bruce Springsteen at one of the Hall of Fames, he's a fine boy. That was definite wall of sound. But the Born to Run album and the albums that Bruce did at that time were very much inspired. You can hear the roots of that sound that you were part of. And I think it was very cool that you and Bruce Springsteen wound up on the stage together at such a high level.
Bruce, that was all in his mind, because I just got this phone call one day from him, and he said, "Hi, it's Bruce." And I said, "Hi, how you doing?"
Mm-hmm.
"I would like for you to do the 25th anniversary of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame with me at the Garden." I said, "When?" And that's how that all came about. But the thing about it was, I said, "What are we going to do?" He said, "Well, I don't know yet. I haven't come up with that." And went on, okay. Now, it's a week before, and I still hadn't heard from him. What are we going to do? You know, it's going to be thousands of people there. It's going to be televised. Is he going to tell me what he's going to do? And about a week before we got ready to do the show, he called and told me he was going to do Fine, Fine Boy, because he does Fine, Fine Girl in his show. And to sit down and talk to Bruce and pick his head about the history of Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band is amazing, because he said he idolized the sound that I did with Phil Spector. So, you know, to compare me as part of that sound was amazing. And, you know, you have to kind of go back and realize, yeah, I was there for all of that. While Phil was creating, I was always there in the studio. He used to call me Doll. Okay, how does this sound? Is this tempo good? You know, and I was sitting there when all that was going on. But today you realize I was really a part of that whole thing.
How do you maintain at 78 years old, and it's something that I deal with at my age and many people coming out of the rock and roll world and who've been in radio a long time are still going strong. How do you keep your energy and your enthusiasm and your wellness day to day at this point with your career?
You know, easy if you want to do it. I love what I do, and I always have felt like this was a gift that God gave me to do. And if I want to do it, He was going to help me do it, and to do it as long as I want to do it. And I've always, when we were coming up, of course, we couldn't afford doctors. We couldn't find, you know, people that kept us in check with our health and things. But as I got older, I realized you have to have quiet time. When I'm doing Broadway shows, I do nothing but those shows. I do 8 shows a week. I come home after the shows. I have a glass of wine. I calm down, and I meditate and get myself together where I'm not up all night looking at the ceiling, what a lot of entertainers do to bring yourself down from those very exciting shows. And rather than doing drugs to come down, I calm myself down by having a glass of wine and start meditating and just being quiet and bringing it all in, what happened during that day, and find out you have to have rest and you have to do it at night, at nighttime hours, somewhere between 11 and 4 or 5 in the morning is when you should be having good sleep. now is not easy because we work at night. But you have to try to do all those things. I always have drank a lot of water, and I've always exercised since I was 16 years old.
Mm. When
I know all of that helps with doing it, and I have such a love for God in my life, and I'm so grateful and I'm so thankful that at the age of 78, I can still do what I do. But I have to do my part, too.
Well, it's true.
You know, I'm a loud talker. If you're ever around me and you heard a loud voice, you say, oh, that sounds like Darlene Love.
I thought I heard a sound coming from New York over the horizon. And it was you.
And I have a very loud laugh. It's contagious. If somebody hears me laughing, they'll start laughing too. I have one of those kind of laughs. But when I'm working, I had to teach myself to talk softly, to talk quietly. Don't do a whole lot. Like when I was doing Broadway for almost three years when I did Hairspray, I really had to physically take care of my body, you know, like I never had before, because I wanted to do every show and I wanted to do a good show every time I performed.
Yeah, right. Now, people don't realize how hard doing a Broadway show for months or a year is. You know,
I told them, I said, you know, when I first started doing Broadway, I said, oh, this would be a piece of cake, you know. Mm. I've done one-nighters, I've traveled. It's the hardest thing I ever did in my life.
I've heard that.
If you're going to do Broadway, you're going to have to love it. And you're going to have to really, you know, the young kids, they would go out after the show. And, I mean, I understood that. But I was the matron in the show. You know, listen, honey, if I'm going to come here next tomorrow night, I got to be in good shape. While they were all out partying and having a good time. I only got sick one time in the 3 years I did that show.
Mm-hmm. When did
so,
you...
You know, just the rigor of just doing 8 shows a week, day in and day out. And they only give you a vacation every 6 months.
Yeah, no, it's brutal.
That's
it's a very, very, very tough, very tough grind. 8 shows and, you know, it's and maintaining not just the stamina to do it, but the enthusiasm about the show. When you do a show that often, it can become rote. And that's not necessarily good for the audience to have that inflicted on them. A bunch of actors on the stage who don't care anymore and are just doing a job. I've seen shows go sour because they lose that.
That's why a lot of them close. Or they keep bringing in different actors after a while because it is a grind, you know. And I always try to, whenever I did a show, I wasn't usually on in the first 15 or 20 minutes of the show. So I always got to work like an hour ahead of time for everybody. I would go in my room, meditate, stretch, do exercises before the show. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's not I get to work 5 minutes before I'm going on stage and go do the show. That's what I think happens. It, you know, and it gets so, it that's how it gets stale.
The word meditate.
I love what I'm doing. I rev myself up.
Yeah, the word, Darlene, the word meditate is a very powerful word, and it's very popular today. People are seeking meditation. How did you become how did you become involved, and when did you become involved in understanding the role and the impact, the positive effects?
Well, you know what? My father was a minister.
Yeah.
I came up in a very religious family. And I have three brothers and a sister, and we were always a calm family, especially toward the day when Sunday was coming. It was Sunday, and then it was Sunday school, it was afternoon service, and that was every day that I could remember that I lived with my parents. And I found out after I was grown, and you know, I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm not going to make me go to church, and you know what I'm saying. Now I'm being rebellious. But then I found out years later that I needed that to keep me going. But what I couldn't be like everybody else, you know, I'm out and I'm partying. Now, I do party. Don't get me wrong. I'm not no goody-two-shoe. But when I'm working, I have to stabilize myself and go, okay, this is what I have to do to keep my life together, how I can relate to my audience, because I always want to please my audience. I want to do the best show I can do, if it's 10 people or if it's 10,000 people.
Right, and partying is a word that has different meanings. I mean, there are certain kinds of parties you have to go to in terms of running the business of your career, and then there are certain parties you don't need to do. You can go home and go to sleep.
Well, you know, because after a show is over, they usually go out to a place that's loud, very loud.
Right.
Music is loud. Everybody's talking loud. Therefore, when you go out, you have to talk loud to get over what you're trying to say while y'all out there partying. And that was detrimental to my voice.
One of the things,
just like you said,
right,
there are parties I had to go to.
One of the shows,
like you said, as part of my business.
Right. Darlene, one of the shows that I want to use this on are some of our news talk shows that we have. And you have an interesting history, and I don't know how much you've talked about this. Starting in South L.A., the daughter of a minister. I suspect it was an African-American community that you lived in.
Yes.
And you were in show business as a young African-American woman. The girl groups were basically black groups. What is your view from this amazing half century of experience and transition that you've lived through? What is your view of America's very difficult race relations situation at present?
That's a very interesting question, and like you said, it's never been really talked about. Because I grew up in, for 5 years, born and raised in California. They sent my father to Texas for 5 years to take over a church. And it was at the age of 10 to 15. And black girl groups, when you wanted to sing, it was just like, oh, you got to be kidding. You're going to sing? Sing where? Well, we sung in school things. We used to, what they call Bobby Sox hops. So you sung at schools. You didn't go too far out of your neighborhood to work, you know, and we weren't, because we were still teenagers, we were still in school. It wasn't a whole lot. But it was almost like it was an invisible fence around us.
Mm.
Black singers, black neighborhoods, black where you could go to the movies, and you stayed in your own community. You never really stretched out and went anywhere, and especially when living in the South in Texas. Well, you know, you didn't think about it because as you got older and saw the rest of the world, you realized you were living really in a very segregated world where we were living.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not nice because people looked down on you as a third-rate person, not even a second-rate person. Why are you even here? Well, we are allowing you to live here. You know, you don't belong here.
Hmm.
You don't deserve to be here. So I think it was, I know it was God that helped a lot of us through a lot of that, especially when it comes to hate or disliking people. They were born that way. They grew up in that. They knew no other way. It helped us being an entertainer once you got out of that environment because the white acts, so to say, loved us. They wanted to be like us. They wanted to sing like us. They wanted to dance and do show business like we were doing it. You know, because before we all came around, you just stand in front of a mic and sing. We weren't allowed to do TV shows, so people didn't know us because they didn't want black people on their television shows, you know, especially the ones that were going international. So it was really something when we got on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah. I remember as a kid, they made a big deal about the fact that Nat King Cole was the first black entertainer who had his own variety show on network TV. Like
and it
wow.
And only for 15 minutes, and he could not get any sponsors.
Ugh. Crazy.
But it was the white entertainers who helped him the first year or so he was on the show. Because they all, the biggest stars in the world during that time, Frank Sinatra, you know, all of those people came to his rescue and they did his show.
It
was like, you know, when you think about it, this was still going on in the 60s.
Yeah, so one of your observations is that even though there has been prejudice in America through all these years and still is, that in the entertainment industry, it was not as prevalent as outside the entertainment.
Because we had everybody, every walk of life in the entertainment business. We had the gays. Mm-hmm. You know, we had everything. We had the establishment singers who was going against the establishment, especially the white ones, because they could. We had to more or less kind of stay to ourselves for a while until we got big enough to we could open our mouth and say things. But it was the white establishment that helped the black entertainers, you know, those of us who had talent. They wanted to be like us, which was a great. And we had most of our friends were in the entertainment world, not anybody outside the entertainment world, because that was our lives. when we traveled together, and they were for us, you know, even when we couldn't travel on the train or buses and things, you know, they would be there for us, you know, they would help us get through the South and all those kind of things. But most of it was done, it was almost like you say, they say, in the corner, in the dark.
Right, right.
You know, we could only sing in certain places, and we called that the Chitlin' Circuit.
Interesting.
That's where the black people were.
And you've seen it change over the years, and the world is a better place today?
Oh, yeah. Especially the entertainment world.
Mm.
You know, it has grown and grown and grown, and at the place where people accept the entertainers.
Right.
And I call everybody, the sports people, the actors, you know, radio people, they're all entertainers. You're an entertainer. That's what you do for a living. You're entertaining. We're all entertainers, even though they call us actors and you're a TV person or whatever. But we're all, and it's all walks of life in that entertainment field because we all came from different walks of life. It's just that we were more able to accept one another in the entertainment community.
How about the role?
We loved one another.
How about the role of women?
For one another.
How about the role of women today? Do you see things getting better for women in the business world and in the world out there in general?
I see it getting better, but you know, it's just like everything else. Everything takes time. It's so long ago that this started that women wanted to be out there. You know, the blacks, I tell people all the time, my mother always had worked. My grandmother worked, always worked. But I had so many white friends who were married that didn't work. I said, why don't you work? My husband won't let me work. You know, the wife stayed at home, but not in the black community. We all worked.
Interesting.
And we had no choice. We had to work.
Right.
You had to have two people in the family working.
One more question, because I told you I would keep you a certain amount of time, and we're there now. But I want to ask you one more question. One of the stories that is part of your legend, and I think it would make a great base for a movie or even a work of fiction. The character that comes to mind somewhere in your career when you were not getting a lot of work, you became a housekeeper and mm-hmm. and were cleaning a woman's bathroom when you heard your song on the radio and that inspired you to get back into the
right.
business. Could you give us a little more insight into that story, and then I'll let you go. Because that I just find that to be absolutely compelling. That here you are, you're on all these records, you have all these hits, you're famous but not famous. Talent.
You know, it was hard because I'd almost given up on myself. I think that was the hardest part, and didn't realize I was really giving up on myself because that was doing the time that I was trying to go from being with the Blossoms and then going out being a solo artist. It was time. Either I had to make that break. And it was Bill Medley, who I dated for a couple of years, said, okay, are you going to stay doing this the rest of your life, or are you going to just go ahead on and try to make this break? And I decided to go on from that day to today to do a solo career. And it was harder than I ever thought it was going to be. And it was during this time I couldn't find work. Because I tell people today, producers want to know you can put butts in the seats. That's all they really care about.
Mm-hmm.
They don't care who you are or how much money you have, but will people pay to come see you? So that's what I was fighting, because nobody knew who Darlene Love was.
Right, right.
You know, they only knew me with the Blossom and as a background singer. So I had to work my way step by step by step out of it. And sometimes it just got so hard where I still had children. I was having problems with my marriage, so I had to find a way to make money, to bring money into the house. So my grandmother said, well, you know what? Everybody called me Doll. You know, I can get you a job with Miss So-and-so, you know, for a while until you get back on your feet. And that's what I started doing. I started doing day work. But I didn't do it as Darlene Love. I did it as Darlene Pete, which was my married name. And they didn't know who I was. But I went in, cleaned their houses, I cleaned like I sing.
Wow. Well, then there were some pretty clean bathrooms.
Just so happens I was cleaning this one lady I was working with. I was in her bathroom cleaning, and it was a beautiful home, mirrors all the way around in the bathroom. And down the hall, I heard Christmas Baby being played on the radio. It was Christmas time. And I hadn't even thought about it. I hadn't even thought about Christmas Baby for years, you know, because it was during that time where the song wasn't that big yet, but they still played it. And then I looked in the mirror at that moment and said, what am I doing? I have a gift. I am talented. I am beautiful. I love what I do. I love people. I love to entertain. I can't reach anybody doing what I'm doing now. So from that day to the day, I have had the trials and the temptation to stop and fall back to do backup, because I am still wanted as a great background singer. People want me to do their background, and I do some of them if I can. But I just strive to be the best and the greatest vocalist I can be. And I've never looked back. And today it's just wonderful how my life has really turned around, because I was persistent. And I believed in myself, and I trusted in God to take me where I have to go, and I just never stopped. I'll never stop until, you know, if I get so tired and my voice said, okay, that's enough, that's when I'm going to stop, but I don't know when that's going to be.
And there you have it, an uninterrupted conversation with Darlene Love, one of the greatest rock and roll singers of her generation and those that followed, still going strong at 78 years of age. To learn more about Darlene Love, visit her website, darleneloveworld.com. Thank you for downloading this program from Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, and the Podcast One app, and for following our Tuesday tweets announcing the names of our weekly guests. To sign up, it's at MH Interview. I can be reached directly via email at michael@talkers.com. If you find this show to be of interest and value, please subscribe to it, as well as giving it a positive 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Our producer is Matthew B. Harrison. The Michael Harrison Interview. Thank you for listening.
The Michael Harrison Interview is a presentation of Podcast One, produced in association with Talkers Magazine and Good Phone Communications. Copyright 2019, all rights reserved.